It is Wednesday, July 28th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon, I'm your host, political analyst Garland Nixon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Facebook gets pressured for censorship based on civil rights. An article in today's edition of the New York Times cites a new 100-page document claiming that Facebook needs to increase censorship on issues related to civil rights and, of course, misinformation. Is this a valid concern or another move to strong-arm Facebook into removing content that is unacceptable to mainstream media and political powers? Here to discuss this, we have Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly is a senior columnist and editor for Black Agenda Report and author of the book, Presidential, Black America and the Presidents. You can follow Margaret on Twitter at Freedom Ride Blog and find her work at blackagendareport.com. Good evening, Margaret, and welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. Okay, so let's start. You know, I looked at this article, and on its face, you would think, okay, well, it sounds like maybe they're moving in the right direction. Facebook decisions were setbacks for civil rights, an audit finds. But the more I look into this, as so many other of these stories regarding Facebook and censorship, it starts to take some, let's just say, nefarious turns. You've had a chance to look over to the article. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, this is very disturbing. Once again, we see liberals, mostly Democrats, asking for censorship. And they do so under the guise of fighting hate speech, opposing President Trump more than anybody else. And it is true that the things he posts on mostly on Twitter would get many other people kicked off. So that is a legitimate concern, except that Facebook is not a disinterested party here. Facebook has been, ever since they were implicated in the phony Russiagate fraud, and it was said that Russians were using Facebook memes to impact the 2016 election, Facebook folded like a cheap lawn chair, as the saying goes, and announced that they would censor us, particularly on the issue of foreign policy, and would follow the dictates of the Atlantic Council. Who's the Atlantic Council? That's NATO. So that means that Facebook began to censor anyone the United States didn't like. So, for example, the South American network Telesur has been banned temporarily, and after complaints, they were allowed back on. There are Palestinian groups who get kicked off if Israel says they don't like them. So this is not a good thing. What people should be advocating for is an end to censorship, to let everybody speak, because there are legitimate sites, the one that I've written for myself, American Herald Tribune, they kick them off of Facebook and off of Twitter. So this is not a good thing. I also find it interesting that organizations like the NAACP and Color of Change are involved here, and Black people as individuals are victimized by Facebook more often. We're more likely to get kicked off if we say something that is considered racist against white people. So any white person can complain and get a Black person kicked off. I certainly hope they raise that issue in their meeting. So this is very, very problematic, and this is not a good thing at all.
Well, the other thing is, you know, there's a couple of things we want to get into, but let's take it for a minute from the perspective of race, and I think it should be, because that's the angle, and I'll use this word, I really mean it. That's the angle that they're playing here, and that's the way I see it, and that's this: as a Black person, I feel like that I'm being used as these organizations, such as the Democratic Party and some of these other really, you know, the neoliberal organizations. I feel like I'm being used as a human shield. And here's what I mean. Mm-hmm. When Black people get together to, you know, let's say there's an issue, there's a problem, and it's something that the Democratic Party and the mainstream media doesn't like, they don't approve of, we see, well, the Russians are now pushing the Black people to say we don't want X. Now I look at this, and if you look into the article, they'll say civil rights or blah, blah, fairness, and then every now and then they'll slip in the word and misinformation. And we know what that means, in that we saw so many times people who, and this is a perfect example, people who questioned whether or not the alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria, in Douma, was valid. People mm-hmm. who questioned that were claimed to be involved in misinformation, only to find out later, what we, you and I already knew, that in fact, mm-hmm. chemical weapons attack never really happened. So when I see, okay, we want you to help black folks by doing whatever, however they're going to help us, I don't know. But additionally, we got to get rid of misinformation. I think of the back to that, oh yeah, the Russians are playing black people to ask for fair rights. It's like, use black people as human shields. And then we have some of this so-called black leadership class and some of these mainstream black organizations jumping in with them. And I think it is not just to the detriment of black people, but I feel like we are being used for nefarious purposes. Margaret.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. But this shows us how these organizations in the political class work. The NAACP, Color of Change, other organizations are wholly dependent on the same donor class as the rest of the Democratic Party. They are tied to the hip with Democratic Party politics. And that means they will use us. This fake concern for us. It's easy to say, I know the Boogaloo Boys, who I've recently heard of, post racist content. Okay, they do. But I would argue, let them. But let everybody, let everyone speak. Unless it is something truly, there's a threat of harm to someone, let everyone post their opinions. But they don't want to let everyone post their opinions. They use black people as a pretext. You're absolutely right. It's supposed to be some anti-racist action. But in fact, they're just being hypocrites. They use us because they want to silence dissent. They want to marginalize the already politically marginalized people who are really on the left, people who question these platforms at all, people who question foreign policy. They want us off, and they want us out and silenced. And it's so easy to use Trump. He's the perfect foil. So you can use Trump, or you could use the Boogaloo Boys, or you could use any number of groups or individuals that nobody, that very few people like, and that most people would agree are offensive in some way, but they're not really the target. So they'll use Alex Jones because aside from, you know, his small group of crazy people, no, who likes Alex Jones? So they'll say Alex Jones can't be on any platform. But I don't think that's a good thing. Let Alex Jones say what he wants. I don't care. But let Telesur say what they want. And let the Venezuelan government say what it wants, and let Palestinian groups say what they want, instead of taking electronic intifada off of these platforms. So I think, so you are correct, they do pick and choose, they do use people. It's always under guise of something benevolent. They want to end racist speech, and I'm not in favor of racist speech, but in so doing, they have an ulterior motive, and it is nothing that benefits us.
Well, let me add this also about the story. So I decided, okay, they mentioned this 100-page document. It was an investigation. So I kind of surfed around the net, and I found it. And there's another angle here that I want to get your comment on. The first sentence of that document says, the investigation into Facebook's policies and practices began in 2018 at the behest and encouragement of the civil rights community and some members of Congress. So here's my point. Once again, the New York Times puts out a story. Ostensibly, it's some civil rights groups who are, you know, working for the good of the order. These are independent civil rights groups. They don't happen to mention that this was done at the behest of members of Congress. Now, they go on to say the audit was led by Laura Murphy, civil rights and civil liberties leader, along with a team from a civil rights law firm, blah, blah, blah. But so here's the question. Someone paid for this. The question would have to be, they didn't. I doubt very seriously if this was done pro bono. It's possible, but someone paid for this. And I wouldn't be shocked if you could dig around and find some tax dollars doing it. But once again, we see the New York Times putting out an article claiming that it's for the good of the order, claiming that it's from some civil rights leaders, et cetera. And when you pull the curtain back, once again, members of Congress, you're going to find the Adam Schiffs and et cetera behind this. And you're going to find the same neocons and Russia gators that are pushing for war. And I have very little doubt. Margaret, what are your thoughts?
Sure. Well, we know that the Democratic Senator Warner from Virginia, he took the lead in this. He personally went to Facebook's headquarters several times in an effort to get them to do more censorship. Now, the angle, as in this case, was about Russiagate and about foreign, especially Russian manipulation of public discourse in this country. And Facebook knew better than anybody that these clickbait ads, these crazy memes, didn't influence anybody. And they know that if Vladimir Putin was going to spend, I think it was $25,000, which is $50,000 in total, and most of it was spent after November 2016, they knew better than anybody that this was nonsense. But they knuckled under to political pressure, and I'm sure to political threats from Senator Warner and others like him. I do think that these social media platforms should be regulated like public utilities are, because that is what they have become. And I would regulate them in a way that they did not censor anyone except those who were actually causing danger to someone, someone yelling fire in a theater or making threats of injury or harm. But anybody else would be allowed to say pretty much whatever they wanted to do. But you're right, it was Democrats who are behind this censorship, and Democrats want to censor the left more than they want to censor anybody. I don't think they're really worried about the racist individuals and groups that I mentioned. They're more worried about people like me having a platform that can impact what people know about domestic and foreign policy in this country.
I also think that I'll get your comment. We got about a minute left to talk, but I want to get your comment. You know, it says in this article leading up to November. I think that we've got a very ugly time regarding censorship coming up leading up to November. In about a minute, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think so. It's already, there's not only censorship, but there's this new propaganda about Trump, that Trump's going to drop out, that Republicans don't want him anymore, that he's going to lose in a landslide. This is all manufactured. I don't see any proof that any of this is real, but it's a way to manipulate the public and try to undo the damage they all did by letting Trump win in 2016. I've often said his victory is completely the fault of the Democratic Party. So we are going to see more complaints about Russian interference, more calls for censorship, but the goal is political and the goal is against the left.
Yes. And of course, there'll be plenty of Russiagate, because there are some thoughts that the president is leaning towards bringing some troops home from Afghanistan. And that is an injustice that cannot be allowed to stand amongst the Washington consensus. I want to thank you very much. Once again, we have been talking to the one and only Margaret Kimberly. Margaret is a senior columnist and editor for Black Agenda Report and the author of Prejudicial: Black America and the Presidents. You can follow Margaret on Twitter at Freedom Ride Blog and find her work at blackagendareport.com. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. More on the other side. Stay tuned. Are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. Trump withdraws from the World Health Organization and downplays the coronavirus risk. A vast array of critics condemned the White House's announcement on Tuesday that the U.S. is formally withdrawing from the World Health Organization. Meanwhile, FBI Director Christopher Wray lambasted China for allegedly, quote, working to compromise America's healthcare organizations. And President Trump dialed up pressure on state and local officials to reopen schools in the fall, despite the meteoric rise of coronavirus cases. Joining me to discuss this issue is Danny Haifong. Dan is the author of a great book. I have a copy myself. It's called American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News. You can follow Danny on Twitter at Spirit of Ho, that's H-O, and read his work at BlackAgendaReport.com. Good evening, Danny, and welcome to the Critical Hour.
Good to be on. Thanks, Garland.
Well, we got a lot to unwrap here, a whole lot to unwrap. Certainly, we're going to talk about a little bit of all of it, but let's start at the beginning. President Trump is withdrawing from the World Health Organization. The U.S. is formally doing that. Despite the fact that we seem to be doing worse than any other country in the world when it comes to the coronavirus, we're blaming the WHO. We're saying they haven't done a good job. I don't know. Maybe President Trump feels like he's, you know, they've made the decisions for the United States. I don't know. But we're formally withdrawing from the World Health Organization. What do you think about that? Is that just a political move maybe for the president, since he's been attacking the WHO, something for his base, you know, a red meat for the base? Does President Trump and his advisors really think this is the best, or is it some combination thereof?
Well, I think that it's a host of things, and it's really in keeping with the way that the Trump administration has approached the COVID-19 pandemic from the beginning by scapegoating China the whole way. Really, the reason why the Trump administration has decided to do this dates all the way back to the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, when the Trump administration spread innuendo that China and the WHO were working together to stifle information and to basically place the world at risk. Well, now months have passed since that time, and we've seen that the United States is actually the worst equipped to handle the pandemic. And by pulling out of the WHO, that only ensures that the United States is without the tools it needs, especially international cooperation that it needs in order to stem the tide of the virus. But as we have seen over the last, especially the last month or two, we have seen that the United States, the Trump administration, and really the entire political establishment has basically given up on trying to contain the COVID-19 pandemic and has instead pushed reopening, which is all about ensuring that capitalist profits remain high at the expense of human lives.
So when I look at what's going on now, I can't help but think to myself that this is kind of a representation of the narcissistic personality of, and you know, I'm not you know, evaluating President Trump clinically as a narcissist, though I suspect it wouldn't be hard to do that if you were a clinician and were able to accurately make that evaluation. But I'm saying from the perspective of narcissistic from the U.S.'s foreign policy, where we say, you know, screw the rest of the world. This is not a world community. This is us. And here's the other thing about narcissism. The narcissist can never, ever take responsibility for their actions. So the U.S. doesn't, particularly under President Trump, maybe more so than ever, but this is not new. We don't say, we screwed up. We made a mistake. Perhaps we should have done better. No, it's the fault of the Mexican immigrants. It's Putin's fault. It's China's fault. And now, regarding something that has to do with health, it has to be whoever the World Health Organization is. So to me, this is a continuation of a broader policy that says we take responsibility, we take credit when something goes well, but whenever something goes bad, if it wasn't the World Health Organization, it was going to be, we already had China, it was going to be someone. The U.S. policy, particularly under President Trump, is we got to blame other people for our mistakes. What are your thoughts?
That's exactly right. And I think another big part of all this is the fact that all of these moves actually serve to damage the United States and the world by pulling out of the WHO. And a lot of the Trump administration's policies has, in effect, isolated the United States, right? I think, as my book sort of outlines, the U.S. really does rely on this image of exceptionalism around the world and its ability to maintain hegemony in a very material sense in all spheres, whether we're talking about economic, militarily, or in the soft power realm, which is what the WHO is really all about as well. The United States is the biggest donor to the United States, I mean, to the WHO up until today. And, you know, the WHO did not damage the U.S.'s role as a hegemonic power around the world. In fact, it could be argued that it strengthened its arm by allowing it to exert soft power around the world. Now, the Trump administration, in an attempt to blame every, you know, country like China and any political force like the Democrats, equating the Democrats with the radical left, all of this sort of deflection is really about avoiding any accountability. And that is going to be an interesting, I think, segue into the election, where the Trump administration has to make the argument that it deserves another 4 years. And regardless of the flaws of the U.S. electoral system, the Electoral College could very well choose him again. But the Trump administration is not making it easier for itself coming into 2020's election.
You know, the other thing, when we talk about FBI Director Christopher Wray lambasted China for allegedly working to compromise America's healthcare organizations. OK, for the last few years, it was Russia and now it's China. And so we blame these other countries. There are two things that I think of when I think of Russia and China. Number one, we're a massive, economically, we're a deficit country. We're unbelievably in debt. When I look at Russia and China, they're surplus countries. They're not in debt. The other thing is, and I don't know if that's related, but I want to throw both of these things in because those are the countries we're blaming everything on. When I look at these two countries, I see countries with strong central governments. And both of these countries with strong central governments, I can go to some of the other countries such as South Korea, and these countries have had their bumps in the road with the coronavirus, but nothing has compared to us. It seems to me the countries with strong central governments were able to have kind of a unified attack, if that's the right word, on the coronavirus, and have had considerable more success than we have. Even Russia. Russia's had a lot of cases, not nearly as many as us percentage-wise, but not nearly the amount of deaths. No one seems to have let it get out of control like we have. So my point is, we're attacking the countries who seem to have strong central governments and seem to have used that particular part of their structure to be able to address the coronavirus. And we're saying that our mess, our kind of loose confederacy in the United States that hasn't done very well, it's all their fault. What are your thoughts, Danny?
Well, it is very true that those countries with strong central governments, we can include Vietnam, Venezuela, Cuba in there as well, have done such an incredible job in containing a virus that is still very new to the world, and that there's still much research to be done in terms of the most effective treatments and the most effective ways of preventing the virus. It just came out today in China that Beijing administration has been able to test 11 million people, or at least have the availability of 11 million tests, and have tested millions of people since their most recent outbreak earlier in June. And so what we're seeing, I think, is that the United States is a failed state, and it's in this free fall decline economically, politically, and militarily, that there is a real crisis of legitimacy in the United States, that people are becoming more and more frustrated with the way that the government works and the way that this economic system works. And we're seeing really the fruits of that in the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as in the uprising that happened against police brutality, which is ongoing. So really the blaming of China is a way to achieve two central objectives. One, to deflect attention from the ills of the U.S.'s political system, and two, to ensure that the geopolitical objectives of the United States can be met in such a dire crisis. The United States has not rested its military buildup around China, and it has not rested its overall expansionist militarist policies around the world, as we saw with the expansion of sanctions against Iran or the saber rattling with China through sending, I think it was the day before July 4th, sending two naval anti-aircraft carriers to the South China Sea. All of these escalations are par for the course and are only justified further by the blame China narrative.
Well, the other thing, there's something that you said, and I didn't think of it from that perspective. I guess there's two ways to look at it. One of the things that you mentioned a few minutes ago is that the U.S. has pretty much given up on the coronavirus, basically given up on containing it. Because the third issue that we want to touch base on in this segment is that President Trump is ratcheting up pressure on state and local officials to reopen schools this fall. You know, during the height of what's becoming the height of the pandemic, that doesn't seem to make much sense. But if we look at it one of two ways, either they've given up or they're only viewing the coronavirus through the lens of economics, that they're not viewing it through the lens of a health crisis. They're not viewing it through the lens of, how it will affect people, the morale of the country, anything else other than, look, we want our economy going. Send the people back to school so that people will feel better, so that the children can go back to school and the parents can go to work. And they're pretty much ignoring the fact that rising coronavirus cases will also likely have the effect on people's ability to go to work. So it appears to me that the way I'd put it is the Trump administration, and not just the Trump administration, our government, because I don't see the Democrats standing up screaming and yelling. I don't see them shaking their fists to the sky saying this can't happen. They seem to have been quiet as church mice here. It appears to me that they've just a decision has been made at the highest levels of our government and spread throughout our government that they are going to view this through the lens of economics and the rest be damned. Danny.
Yes, you're exactly right. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic has been such a critical example of disaster capitalism. The billionaire and soon to be trillionaire class has run away with massive profits and has been bailed out over and over and over again throughout the pandemic. Well, there have been no economic protections for workers, and there's been really no protection generally for workers. And this is what this push to reopen schools is all about. It's just reinforcing this notion that, in fact, the profits of big corporations and the overall quote-unquote economy, the capitalist economy of the United States, is more important than people's safety. And where countries have successfully contained the virus or have addressed the virus effectively, economic protections were in place. In China, nobody lost their job because of the pandemic. Everyone, it was a national mandate for companies to keep people on the rolls. In Venezuela, small and medium businesses, as well as workers, were provided their paychecks as they quarantined. So there were other places that were really setting a model of what protection really looks like. But here in the United States, the push is to ensure the safety and the stability of the stock market, Wall Street, and the economic monopolies, the giants, the private capitalist monopolies that control society, and the health and the well-being and the lives of workers be damned.
Viewing this from the perspective of the world community, we've only got a minute, but it appears that the U.S. is making it clear we're not part of the world as a community. About 30 seconds, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The United States does not view the world as a community. The United States views the world as its imperial playground. It views the world as its potential colony or neo-colony to be exploited and rendered basically subservient to the dictates of private profits.
Exactly my thoughts. It seems that the Trump administration and the U.S. period sees the world as a hierarchy. And we're not even, it's not that we're at the top of the hierarchy. We are not even a part of the hierarchy. We're like a god that rules over the hierarchy. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Danny Haifong, author of American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News. You can follow Danny on Twitter at Spirit of Ho, that's H-O. You can read his work at blackagendareport.com. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. More on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also affectionately known as AMLO, is visiting President Trump to celebrate the entry into force of the Mexican-United States-Canada Treaty. Many of his countrymen are condemning this visit at the height of the pandemic. Is this visit ceremonial or a show of political support? For insight, we turn to my next guest, Professor Jack Rosmus. Professor Rosmus, I'm having a time with his name, but we'll get it right. He's a professor in the Economics and Politics Department at St. Mary's College. He's an author, he's a journalist, and a radio host. You know, your name is just tongue-tying me today. I'm going to get it right, but it's something about all of those S's and M's that's tongue-tying me. But good evening, and welcome to the Critical Hour.
Well, glad to join you, as always.
All right. So it's kind of, you know, sad. I could pronounce Andrés Manuel López Obrador fine, and Rasmus I'm struggling with. At any rate, so let's talk about this. You know, certainly we know they redid the NAFTA treaty, and there's a new, the TMEC, as they call it, treaty. And, you know, the president of Mexico would kind of be expected to do some kind of a formal ceremony, but he's getting a lot of pushback about this. What are your thoughts on the dynamic surrounding this and why the pushback is coming just now?
Well, you know, this is to sort of celebrate, if they would, the signing of the USMCA, the agreement that follows NAFTA, which is really just a tweaking of NAFTA. There's not much change there at all. We won't go into the terms of that of the USMCA. A lot has been written on it, but you know, listeners should just know that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. Not a lot actually done there. To change NAFTA, which has cost millions of jobs, U.S. jobs, but that's just the cover. You see, they wouldn't be coming. AMLO would not be coming out to Washington simply to do that. Other party to the USMCA, Trudeau, there, the Prime Minister in Canada, he's not coming. There's other reasons for his appearance, for AMLO's appearance to Washington here, not just the surface. Celebrate the signing on July 1st of the USMCA deal. You know, for Trump's point of view, what you're going to see from him is he's going to tout the fact that the agreement with Mexico has resulted in a sharp reduction of immigration from the South. Well, that's because people don't want to come to, the worst virus country in the world.
I was about to say, it's had a sharp reduction. There's been a sharp reduction of immigration from everywhere because nobody wants to come here and catch the coronavirus because we're kind of the epicenter of the world.
Yes, we are.
If his plan was to stop immigration by giving everybody in the United States the coronavirus, that's been a pretty successful plan.
Yeah, well, you know, he's going to tout that deal with Mexico. You know, Mexico, AMLO is pretty much bent to what Trump wanted. Mexico deployed 29,000 troops to stop the immigration already for the past year from Central America through Mexico. So, AMLO does the bidding of Trump on this particular issue. And, Trump's going to use it as an excuse to really, tout his immigration policy, how its success has been successful. He'll take credit for it. But there's even more behind that, I think. He's going to be appealing, Trump will, to the Latino vote in the whole process. You know, he wants to show he's got good relationships with Mexico now, and there'll be some sort of offensive here to try to garner some more Latino votes, especially since his old racist attitude, on African Americans has collapsed. There was several months ago before the virus an attempt by the Trump administration to appeal to an African American vote, but that's kind of collapsed with his blatant racism now. So he's turning to the Latinos, and that's behind the visit here, too. But it doesn't really explain why AMLO is coming, you see. I believe there's more to this meeting than just even electoral politics. And it's certainly more than, touting the USMCA deal. I think this has to do with Trump putting pressure on AMLO to get Mexico to buy two things, more U.S. farm goods. Because clearly Trump's trade deal with China has collapsed. You know, he bragged last December that China would be buying $150 dollars of more goods from the U.S. this year, and about $40 billion of that would be agricultural goods, farm goods. Well, China so far, the report just came out, has bought $2 billion. So, you know, he hasn't delivered for the farm sector in an election year here. So I think he's going to put more pressure on Mexico to buy more U.S. Farm goods. And also, I think he's going to put pressure on AMLO in the meeting to buy more U.S. natural gas. Before AMLO came to office here in 2018, I think it was, December of 18, his predecessor had signed a deal with the U.S. here for a natural gas pipeline into Mexico. And the U.S. has this massive glut of natural gas that it's trying to peddle around the world now. And natural gas prices are falling in the U.S., therefore profits of these companies. And I think he's going to put pressure for Mexico to complete this pipeline and buy more U.S. natural gas. But the real plum, I think, of why AMLO is coming is that AMLO is trying to renationalize Pemex, the Mexican oil company, and he needs the agreement of the U.S., and the oil companies and the investors in the U.S. to do this, because Pemex is $100 billion in debt to U.S. investors right now. AMLO is depending on his whole term in office to successfully renationalize Pemex so that it can increase the output, and the sales from the oil will go to fund his budget. Right now, American companies, investors are sucking up a lot of value out of Pemex, and Pemex really needs to be upgraded in terms of new technologies, and they're refusing to do that. They're just dragging money out of Pemex while it collapses. So I think AMLO is here to try to get the agreement of Trump to allow him to go through with the nationalization of Pemex. In exchange, you know, he may do things that Trump wants to have done, because the U.S. still has tariffs on Mexico. Despite this free trade thing that they say, the U.S. still has tariffs on Mexican steel and aluminum and other items as well. And just because Trump signed an agreement doesn't mean he's not going to impose more tariffs, especially in an election year. So there's a lot of economic issues here. For AMLO, it's Pemex. And for Trump, it's farm goods and natural gas and so forth. And I think that's really why he's coming. They can't have these negotiations by third parties, which would come out into the open in an election year. And even AMLO has the midterm elections next year, you see. So I think these guys are getting together, and AMLO is coming to trade whatever Trump wants in exchange for what he wants with Pemex. I think that's the story.
Well, you know, I'm glad you went there, because, I read online, I read a number of critiques of AMLO and criticisms, and generally they were politically oriented. And I thought the thing I immediately thought was, you know, this country, regardless of what he thinks of Trump or what the people who are writing these articles think of President Trump, this is a huge neighbor. You're right next to this gigantic economy and much indebted to a lot of their banks. And I felt the same that you, that this was somewhat of a trade summit, you know, about the 15th mm-hmm. of June, a number of, I particularly remember seeing an article in Reuters that said that President AMLO was saying that he would sell gasoline to Venezuela for humanitarian reasons if asked to. And I felt that he wouldn't necessarily do it, that that was some kind of a chess move. That was some kind mm-hmm, of, mm-hmm. I think part of it was to show solidarity within the South American and Central American community, because he is a very left-leaning guy, and to show some level of solidarity with Nicolas Maduro, even though the likelihood is that he wasn't doing it. It was kind of like a head nod towards President Maduro. But let me get your thoughts. What are your thoughts basically on the Mexican president doing that head nod, or whatever you may, however you may see it, saying that he would sell gasoline to Venezuela about a month ago, and then, you know, a month later coming here and having this, what we, I think, can agree is a bit of an economic trade summit with President Trump?
Well, that might, you know, as you said, it might have been a chess move on AMLO's part, selling, gasoline to Venezuela, but I don't think that's going to happen. you know, I mean, the Trump administration has already begun a blockade of Venezuela. They've got ships down there very quietly. At some point, I think it may be an October surprise of sorts to really totally blockade the country. It's a possibility, and create a foreign policy crisis here to help Trump get reelected. He could do that with Iran and, who knows, maybe North Korea, China, whatever. But I don't think that's the real issue here. And, Mexico will, if it were going to do that, he would, AMLO would stop if he gets his deal on Pemex. You see, that's the number one thing for AMLO right now economically, to renationalize Pemex. He gets a big political push from that. We took it back from the Yankees, and he gets the big revenue, even though oil prices are down, that he needs to finance his social programs. That's the linchpin to his economic program. And I think he's coming, and he's going to be willing, AMLO, wheel and deal on a whole number of fronts with Trump to allow Trump to to tout he got these big agreements from Mexico, and he pushed them even further and so on and so forth. You see, you got to understand AMLO. AMLO to Mexico in 2018 is very similar to what Obama was to the U.S. in 2008. They turned, the Mexican big capitalist turned to a more popular figure because the previous PAN leaders I forget the name of the other movement there. They had become so corrupt, so obvious, they couldn't win any elections. So, they've allowed AMLO to come in, and AMLO talked the talk, but he isn't walking much of the walk since he's come in, you see. He's done a few visible things, like stopping the boondoggle at the airport there in Mexico City. In terms of really delivering the goods as a populist, a progressive populist, he hasn't really done that.
We're running kind of short of time, but let me throw one more question at you. We got you could talk for about a minute and a half on that end. And that is, get this close to the election. I would think that he could bargain, particularly on immigration. And here's why it would be easy. He could give President Trump all kinds of things on immigration for this reason, because he doesn't have to worry about it. Nobody's crossing the border anyway. So he could come there and say, here, when it comes to immigration, I'm going to give you the entire farm. And President Trump could say, thanks. And he could tout this great victory in immigration because he doesn't have to worry about it, because it would just be it's not going to be real anyway, because there's no immigration. About a minute and a half. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, something will come out of this meeting that have to do with Trump saying we've agreed to something even more restrictive on the immigration front. But it will be a lot of smoke and mirrors for the reasons that you say. But something will come out of this, some joint statement on immigration will make Trump look like he's being even more aggressive on immigration than Mexico's agreeing with it and cooperating with him on it. Something will come out economically, too, I think, for the farm sector. Trump has to do more visibly for the U.S. Agribusiness, the farm sector, because his deal with China has collapsed in terms of them buying more U.S. farm exports. And he really needs to prop up his red state base, which is heavily agricultural, Midwest and so forth. So I think something will come out on the farm, farm purchases here. They'll put it in. Look how successfully the USMCA is going and doing. Behind the scenes, I think there'll be more something to do with the natural gas pipeline. But this is a trade negotiations with an overview of the November elections kind of a meeting. This is what this is really about.
All right. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Professor Jack Rasmus. I think I got it right that time. Professor in the Economics and Politics Department at St. Mary's College. He's also an author, a journalist, and a radio host. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. More on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon, standing in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. State and local governments are facing fiscal disaster as tax revenues are expected to decline alongside stagnant and lessening economic growth. Leading experts on Tuesday warned more financial pain could be on the horizon for working Americans without continued assistance from the federal government. Joining us to discuss this issue, we're now fortunate to have Dr. Linwood Tawheed, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and President of the National Economics Association.
Thank you.
So let's move forward to the important stuff. Important, but really not pleasant. Let's start with this. You know, what is your evaluation of the response to date of the Trump administration? Not just the Trump administration, because let's face it, both parties got together. They decided to do a massive bailout for the corporations and a few bucks here and there for the average Joe. We looked at, you know, when compared to some of our allies and even some of our adversaries who, you know, at times we see that some of the other countries guaranteed up to 80% and 90% of the income for working people in their nation. So let's start here. What is your evaluation so far of the economic response of our government to the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, it's been, as you just characterized it, it's been a tremendous bailout for corporations and meager pennies for the general public. For regular people. And of course, Republicans and Democrats have some blame in that imbalance. You know, the Republicans and Democrats both, you know, responded with a massive bailout to $2.2 trillion. At least that's the public face of it. And most of that money was going to go to large corporations, supposedly, to help them to continue with their workers and not put them on layoff to pay their workers. But there was a portion of it that was also, you know, to go to small businesses. Now, small black-owned businesses have not gotten their fair share. And so there was an attempt by the Democrats to put forward a second round of these bills, but Mitch McConnell says he's not even going to bring it up to a vote. But my question for the Democrats would be, why didn't they push for a stronger bill in the first place? And why did they think that the Republicans, after the first bill, would even allow a second bill to come up? So the idea that the weaknesses in the first bill would be fixed by the second bill, if that was believed by the Democratic leadership, then, you know, I've got some land in Arizona to sell there. I don't think they could possibly have believed that that would have happened. But, you know, the big part, the best part of the bill was the $600 a week increase in unemployment insurance. But that's being thwarted by state governors, particularly governors in red states, who are attempting to force workers to go back to work, therefore taking them off the unemployment rolls. And so even though, you know, it was a good provision, there are those who are working around even paying out that $600 a week benefit. And so it was a response. It was I won't say quick response, but it was a needed response. But it was much, much too little for Main Street and the typical more than enough for Wall Street.
Well, the other thing I think that has to be taken into account, there's plenty for us to talk about here, but the other thing that has to be taken into account is that throughout the government, you know, throughout the United States and various states, there are various criteria and standards to qualify for unemployment, number one. But number two, that the infrastructure that is used to apply for unemployment, the websites, the software, the hardware, et cetera, varied so much. And some of it was, you know, basically, you know, it was kind of like the Flintstones, I think, in Florida. They might have been using stone tablets and chisels based on their ability to address the needs of the people. And also, let me add this, with the $1,200 check, we have people to this day who qualified for the $1,200 one-time payment who haven't gotten it. So the other part was that the government here didn't do the things they needed to get the money out to the people who needed it as quickly as they could. And when you look at the people who didn't get it, it appears that those who were most in need, oftentimes they didn't apply online. Maybe, you know, poor people maybe were barely online, didn't have the skills or the ability to go online and do their taxes and therefore get direct deposit. So it appears to me that even the money that was given out, it was much more difficult to get to those who needed it most. What are your thoughts, Dr. Talley?
Well, the pandemic is laying bare for everyone to see, even those who might have tried to deny it, the inequalities in society. And so those who are being more adversely affected by coronavirus are those who are poor. And what's interesting is that our essential workers who are, being forced to work because they are essential, they can't be laid off, are generally our lowest paid workers. Which is not what the myth of the American economy is supposed to say. Those who are essential should be paid the most, but we find that they're being paid the least. They're being put in harm's way, and even those who are laid off are finding that they don't really qualify for unemployment insurance because they're only on temporary furlough. They're not really being laid off. That is, they were furloughed with the expectation that they would come back to work, and that disqualifies many of them for unemployment insurance. So those who need it the most even are not even able to get qualified for the bailout. And on the other side, those who need it the least, the large corporations are getting money, even money that they're supposed to earmark to keep their employees from being laid off, to pay payroll. Many of them have found loopholes around that and are using it for other things. They've already, for example, laid off workers, and then they get the money not to lay off workers. Well, there's no provision for them to bring those workers back. And so the wealthy corporations, large corporations, are taking advantage of the situation, which should have been expected. That's not an unexpected thing, but it also should not have been expected that people who need this help the most would get so little. I mean, $1,200 one time payment is perhaps a couple of weeks of support for those who are low paid workers.
Yes, particularly, I mean, if you are in rural Mississippi, that may do something for you. If you're in Washington, D.C., you know, if you're Maryland, the area where I live, $1,200 is not going to go far. The other thing I think we have to look at, I mean, we see that our response has been from my perspective, rather than a response to the economy, rather than a response to a health crisis, an ideological response that this is the way we do things because of what we believe in. Economically. And here's what I mean. Even if we looked at this from the perspective of enlightened self-interest, yes, America's going to do, or the politicians are going to do what's best for their self-interest. But from a perspective of long-term, we look at Germany. Germany's unemployment rate went from 5% to 6%. Ours went from 3-something to 20-something. So even from the perspective of if the politicians are looking out for their best interest, looking out for getting reelected, this wasn't even smart. This wasn't even in their best interest in the long term. When I look at it, it seems just like a hardcore ideologue type response that says, this is what we're going to do because we're rugged individualists and results be damned. We're just going to move forward and say people will pull themselves up by their bootstraps, even though they can't go to work. They have no way of bringing money in. And we knew before this even happened that 60% of Americans did not have $500 in the bank for an emergency. Dr. Talhid, what's your response?
Well, you mentioned earlier that European nations are doing income replacement of 80 to 90%. Now, that's because most European countries, Germany is a good example, have what's called an industrial policy, where they understand that people will be laid off, but they need to be helped in the transition between one job and the next. And so the country is going to maintain that income. Now, maintaining that income maintains consumption. And if you don't maintain that income, then people don't have an income, they can't consume, and so other parts of the economy begin to decline because other parts don't have customers. And so if you are really concerned about the economy, you have to be concerned about those folks who are laid off and supplement their income. You have to have an industrial policy. And also part of that German and European industrial policy is that people who are laid off because one industry is in decline, maybe permanent decline, are going to be retrained for into industries that are ascendant. That's a policy that says that the country, the federal government, has a responsibility for all of the people and for the economy, and can do good work in keeping an economy from going into stagnation. We're officially in a recession. European countries have a built-in stabilizers to avoid those kind of situations. The United States does not. Rugged individualism or American exceptionalism is part of that, but it's also a part of a process whereby labor is that big business intends to make sure that labor is disciplined. I use that term, meaning that people will work for little, because if you have no job, then you're willing to go to work for less than you had when you were laid off before.
The last thing I want to ask you, we've got about a minute and a minute and a half. People have learned something from this, and that is the economy is basically push the pause button. There's very little, demand. There's supply isn't needed much because there's not much of a demand. But the stock market is still roaring. So one of the things we've learned is the stock market no longer has any relevance to the major economy. In about a minute, maybe you could comment on that.
Well, I think it does have a relevance, and the relevance in the soaring stock market, as people and more people are being laid off, is that companies are understanding that they can hire those people back at lower wages than they were earning when they were formerly employed. Lower wages means greater future profit. So that's the connection. In many cases, what happens on Wall Street is a response to the disaster that's happening on Main Street. In many cases, that disaster is welcomed by those who are in control because it's going to benefit them financially.
Yes, and I might add to me, the other important factor is that for all of those who call this a market economy, I don't see how you can use that term at all anymore, because my understanding is the government has decided that they will buy all corporate bonds. So now, correct me if I'm wrong, the government is now the creditor for all corporations, correct?
It can be, yes. It put itself in the position to buy back bonds for major corporations that are failing. We call that capitalism for the poor and socialism for the rich.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Linwood Tauheed, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I will look forward to talking with you all tomorrow night right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe, peace and blessings, and I am out.